long time ago in Bethlehem, so the Holy Bible say, Mary's boy child, Jesus Christ, was born on Christmas Day. I don't know if you know that song, if you know those words. Remember how it goes on? Hark now, hear the angels sing. A king was born today, a man, and man will live forevermore because of Christmas Day. Now that's quite a claim to make, isn't it? That mankind will live forevermore because of a baby born on Christmas Day. How can we be sure of that? How can you be sure that you have a future beyond your 70 years and 10? How can you know for certain that you will live forevermore? And what the gospel tells us, what Paul wants us to know in the passage we're going to look at this morning, is that it's because of Jesus. It's because of that baby born, Mary's boy child, Jesus Christ, that baby born in Bethlehem, because of who he is and because of what he's done for us. Paul is going to tell us here that Mary's firstborn son, the Gospels tell us that Jesus is Mary's firstborn, who was wrapped in swaddling clothes and laid in a manger. He had brothers and sisters. He was conceived by the Holy Ghost, born of the Virgin Mary, but Mary did not continue to be a virgin perpetually. The Gospels talk about his brothers and his sisters, and some of the New Testament writings are James, the letter of James, for example, is Jesus' half-brother. So what Paul is going to tell us this morning in the passage we're going to look at, and it's the passage from Colossians, if you want to turn to that, is that Mary's firstborn child is actually the firstborn of all creation and the firstborn from the dead. That's where we're going this morning. So you might want to turn to that passage, Colossians chapter 1 and verses 15 to 20. What we have here in all probability is an early Christian song. I'd like to think it was a Christmas carol. That's probably going too far. But we know from chapter 3 of Colossians that the early Christians used to sing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs to each other. We know from church history, for example, Pliny, the Roman governor of Bithynia, writing to the Emperor Trajan in 112 AD, describes the Christians in Bithynia as a bunch of people who are in the habit of singing hymns to Christ as God. That's what Christians do. That's one of the distinguishing marks of a gathering of Christians. They're a bunch of people who sing hymns to Christ as God. That's probably what this is. This is a gospel hymn. This is one of the hymns in the early church, a hymn of praise to Christ as God. I would like to think it's a Christmas carol. They probably didn't have such things. And it's all about Jesus, isn't it? Every line in this song is about Jesus. Don't know if you noticed that. Look at the way in which it starts there in verse 15. He, that is Jesus, he is the image of the invisible God. He, that baby in the manger, that firstborn son of Mary, he is the image, the icon, the exact representation of the invisible God. Spike Milligan was once asked, do you ever pray? You know Spike Milligan? I think, wasn't he Australian? He lived in Australia for a time. Famous comic. The Goons? Nobody remembers The Goons? Good. I'm in the right generation then. And Spike was asked if he ever prayed, and he famously said, yes, I pray desperately all the time. I just don't know. I've got no idea who I'm praying to. And I guess that goes for a lot of people. I don't know about you. What God do you pray to? You say, well, I don't believe in God. Okay. Tell me what God you don't believe in. There are many gods, aren't there? So many gods. It seems there are as many gods almost and spiritualities and philosophies as there are people on earth. Hinduism has 330 million gods. And then there are the Norse gods and the Greek gods and the Roman gods and the Egyptian gods and the Aztec gods and And so it goes on. How many gods are there? Which God is it that you don't believe in? The chances are we don't believe in him either, or her, or she, or it, or whatever it is. Human beings are incurably religious, and there are many gods out there with a small g. Which God do you believe in, or don't you believe in? It's not that God has multiple personalities. It's not that he can't express himself properly, as we'll see. The reason we're told there is in verse 21, it's because we are alienated from him. Do you see that there in verse 21? Once you were alienated from God and were enemies in your minds because of your evil behavior. And because of that, because of our evil behavior, we shut God out. We are alienated from him. We look up into the sky, and what we see is a kind of gigantic mirror. We look up into the sky, but all we ever see is ourselves reflected back. So intelligent people think that God is a giant intellect. Powerful people think he's a mighty force. Groovy people think he's a cosmic vibe or something like that. But what is God like? Who is God? What does the Bible tell us? How can we know what God is like? And the Bible says there's only one right answer to that question, and it's the baby born in the manger, the baby in Bethlehem. He is the image of the invisible God. So I don't look to my feelings to tell me what God is like. I don't look to philosophy. I don't look to science. I don't look to art to tell me who God is. I don't look to popular opinion to tell me who God is. I look to Jesus. And whatever I thought God was like beforehand, I see Jesus and I say, wow, that's who God is. That's what God is really like. And isn't that fantastic good news? Tom Torrance was an army chaplain in the Second World War. He went on to become moderator of the Church of Scotland. And he, looking back on his time as an army chaplain on the front line in the First World War, he said, there was one question that the troops would always ask, the soldiers would always ask me this question again and again and again. More than anything else, they would ask, is God really like Jesus? That's what they wanted to know. As the bullets were flying, as their friends were being blown apart in the trenches in those awful conditions, this is the one thing they needed to know. Is God, what is God like? Is God really like Jesus? And he said, it was my privilege to go through the Gospels and to show them again and again and again from the Scriptures that yes, there is no un-Jesus-likeness in God. That is such a profound truth. There is nothing un-Jesus-like in God. I don't know what you think God's like. I don't. Maybe you think of him as the impossible dad who's impossible to please. And he's always down on you. He's never encouraging. He's always expecting too much of you. Or you think of him as the cosmic policeman who's looking over your shoulder all the time, making sure you're not putting a foot wrong. I don't know what picture you have in your mind about God right now. Forget about it all. If you want to know what God is like, look at Jesus. There is nothing un-Jesus-like about God. If you've seen me, Jesus said to Thomas, you've seen the Father. Nobody has ever seen God at any time, John tells us. But he, the one who was at the Father's side, he has made him known. Veiled in flesh. We sing that. We'll sing that tomorrow morning on Christmas Day again. Veiled in flesh, the Godhead, see. Hail incarnate deity. That's who Jesus is. Lord Byron, the poet, once said, if God isn't like Jesus, he ought to be. Everyone knows. Everyone knows what Jesus is like. Look at his life. Look at how he came into the earth, stooping to the manger. Look at how he was born in obscurity, in oppression, suffering. Look at how he taught. Look at the way he related to people, how he loved people. Look at how he healed. Someone has put it like this, that he was like a little oasis of heaven restoring Eden wherever he went. I think that's a beautiful summary of the Gospels. He went about doing good, the Gospels tell us. We just go about, don't we? But he went about doing good, and wherever he went, it was almost like Eden restored. He was like a kind of little oasis of Eden, restoring Eden wherever he went. Look at how he treated the marginalized and the oppressed and the downtrodden. Look at how he stood up to the authorities, how he stood up to the religious authorities, how he tore down the religious hypocrites. Think of how he washed his disciples' feet. Think of how he stretched out his arms on that cross and how he bled and died for you. You know what, do you know what you're looking at? You're looking at the very image of God. And that's why we can rejoice at Christmas time, really rejoice. Joy to the world. Not superficial sentimentality, not a weekend off, you know, and good food and lots of nice company and that kind of joy. No. This is profound joy, isn't it? We can rejoice because Thor is not God, and fate is not God, and chance is not God. Jesus is God. He is the very image of God, of the invisible God. But we need to know who this Jesus is, and Paul tells it to us here. He sums it up for us in this little song, in this hymn, in these two great statements, in verses 15 to 17 and then in verses 18 to 20. In verses 15 to 17, he's telling us this, that Mary's firstborn son is actually the firstborn of all creation. That's the first thing he wants to show us. But then he goes on to show us in verses 18 to 20 that Mary's firstborn son is also firstborn from the dead. So let's think about that, and then we'll begin to appreciate just the magnitude of what happened on that first Christmas day. So what does Paul mean when he calls Jesus the firstborn of all creation? The JWs and the cults sometimes sort of pick up on that, and they say, well, that just goes to show that Jesus is a creature. He might be a magnificent creature. He might be the first to be created, but he is part of creation. Well, superficially, you might think that, but you just look at the passage and read these verses and you'll see that actually that is not what Paul is saying at all. Because there in verse 16, he reminds us that by him all things were created. By him all things were created. Jesus can't be the creator of all things if he is one of the things that has been created, can he? I mean, that doesn't make sense. Jesus is not the first creature. He is the eternal Son of God. There was never a time when he didn't exist along with his Father and the Holy Spirit. So what does Paul mean when he calls Jesus the firstborn of all creation? Well, it's a figure of speech that we're all very familiar with. We know that Charles is the heir to the throne of England. He is the firstborn son of the Queen, and that makes him heir to the throne. Solomon was not the first child to be born to David in the Old Testament. You can check that up. Solomon chronologically was not the first baby, the first child to be born to David, but he's described in the Bible as the firstborn, David's firstborn, because he is the one who is going to inherit David's throne. It's the picture of primogeniture, I think we call it. That's the word, isn't it? I'm not sure if I pronounce it the right way. It's about inheritance. And so the firstborn inherits all that the Father has. And that's the picture here. When Paul calls Jesus the firstborn of all creation, he's saying, it's all coming to him. It all belongs to him. He made it, and he made it for himself. He is the heir of all things. The firstborn of all creation. For by him and through him and for him all things were created. And he is before all things. And in him all things hold together. See, That's who this baby is. He is the supreme Lord and ruler of the universe. He is the king of the cosmos. That's why it is a cosmos, because he holds it together. Otherwise, it would be chaos. See, that's what it says there, doesn't it? He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. Imagine watching a game of cricket, as you will be doing, I'm sure, some of you, many of you perhaps, the next few days. Not me, I can assure you. Can't think. It's like watching paint dry as far as I'm concerned. But I'm very un-Australian. I ought to be deported, I think. But some of you will be wasting hours in front of the television set watching this strange game. Imagine if you're seeing it for the first time, if you come from another planet somewhere or from a country where they don't play cricket, and you're watching this game on the telly for the first time, the Boxing Day test, and you've never seen a game of cricket before. And as you watch the game, if you're clever enough, you can work out the rules of the game. So on a more kind of basic level, because the ball, on a more basic level, you can work out the law of cause and effect. So why do the bales fly off? It's because the ball has hit them. And what does that mean? Well, it means that he's out. And you can figure that out for yourselves, can't you? And so you get it, you get engrossed into the game. You get sort of interested in it, I suppose, that game that you're watching. And yet, all the time, all that activity, all that story that you're getting excited about there, is being sustained by the cathode tube in your TV set, or whatever the modern equivalent might be. And if it were not for that, there would be nothing there but fuzziness. And in the same way, well, maybe not quite in the same way, it's not a good illustration really, is it? But in a kind of similar kind of way, you can look at the world around you. You can look at what we regard as reality. You can look at the things that are happening in your own family circle and in the world around you. And you can work out the principles and the rules of how it happens. We call that science. Science works by observation. We observe how things happen, and we draw up rules and laws and principles. And so you can watch a David Attenborough program, and you can marvel at the wonders of the natural world. You can watch that guy Brian Cox, the pop star who's also an astrophysicist, and you can marvel at the vastness of the universe. And yet all of that is being held together moment by moment by that baby in the manger. If it wasn't for him, there'd be no cosmos. It would be chaos. It was all made by him. It was all made for him. And he holds it all together moment by moment. I don't know if we ever really think much about that. We live in a universe made by Jesus, shaped by Jesus, inherited by Jesus, and held together by Jesus. We generally don't think about Jesus. We generally think Christlessly about the universe, don't we? I mean, if somebody were to ask you what was before all things, you'd probably say, oh, some big black nothingness. If you were to ask me what holds everything together, I'd probably show my ignorance and say the law of gravity. And I'd be wrong. The answer is Jesus. He is before all things, and in him all things consist. And that's the wonder of Christmas. We're going to sing about it again in a moment. Lo, within a manger lies he who built the starry skies. In a manger. You know the story where we're so familiar with it at Christmas time, and we just read it again this morning, the story of how the wise men came from the east to see the baby Jesus. I think Jesus was probably a bit of a toddler by the time they arrived. If you read Matthew's account carefully, it was after his birth in Bethlehem. And if you read Matthew chapter 2, you'll find that he's now in a house. And you remember that Herod has issued a decree that all children under the age of 2 were to be exterminated. And so there's some time that has gone by when the wise men turn up. But you remember the story, we just read it, about how they turn up at the house. And what do you do when you see a baby for the first time? It's lovely at the moment here at Ann Street, especially in the 10:30 congregation, though there's not so many of those living creatures around at the moment. But there's quite a few new babies have been born into the congregation. And some Sundays I get really excited at 10:30 because the congregation seems to be really attentive, really alive, and they're smiling. And then I realize there's a baby sitting in front. We're so desperate to make that little baby smile, aren't we? We do all sorts of silly things, that sort of thing. And here are these distinguished, intelligent, dignified men from the East, and they come to the house in Bethlehem eventually when they find out where it is. And what do? They fall on their faces and they worship that baby. You'd never catch me worshiping a baby. You'd think I'd gone soft in the head if I started to do that. In Bible times, you didn't worship anyone except Yahweh, except God. And to bow down and worship a baby, that is shocking. That's what they did. Who is that in yonder stall? At his feet the shepherds fall. 'Tis the Lord, oh wondrous story. 'Tis the Lord, the King of glory. That's the first thing that Paul wants us to understand. He is the first, Mary's firstborn is the firstborn of all creation. And then see what he goes on to say in the second part of this song, in verses 18 to 20. This one who is the Lord of all creation, look what he says. It's a bit of an anticlimax, I think, isn't it? In verse 18, he says, he is the head of the church. Head of the church? If I was the creator of the universe, being the head of the church wouldn't exactly thrill my heart, especially after the Royal Commission. So what does Paul mean? See, Paul is talking here not about the church as an organization with head office and a hierarchy of clergy. What does he mean when he says about Jesus that he is the Lord, that he is the head of the church? Well, look what it says, head of the church, his body. This is church as an organism. He is the brains. He is in charge. He is the life source of this body. In his incarnation, through his birth in that stable in Bethlehem, Jesus ties himself to his people so intimately that wherever the head goes, the body goes. That wherever he goes, his people go. And that is terrific news because, according to verse 18, he is the firstborn from the dead. That's why you're going to live forevermore. Because your head, Jesus, is the firstborn from the dead. He plunged down into death. He descended into everything that destroys and perverts his creation. He took all that stuff upon himself and plunged into hell itself on the cross so that he could burst out the other side into a new kind of resurrection life and take you with him. Take with him everyone who believes, everyone who trusts, everyone who is part of his body. The firstborn, just as Roger Bannister was the first one to break through the 4-minute mile barrier. Just as Neil Armstrong was the first man to stand on the moon. Just as Sir Edmund Hillary was the first man to climb Everest. So Jesus is the firstborn from the dead. Never to die again. And guess what? He is the head of the body of which you are living members by grace. That's something to rejoice in, isn't it? Back in July 1991, Gareth Griffiths, who must have been Welsh with a name like that. Back in 1991, Gareth, aged 27, jumped out of an aeroplane strapped to the back of his instructor. It was his first ever parachute jump. At 13,000 feet, the parachute didn't open. At 6,000 feet, the emergency secondary chute opened, but it got tangled with the first. And so these two men, desperately clinging to each other, crashed towards the earth at 120 miles an hour. It was captured on someone's phone. And afterwards, the police examining the video were astonished at what they saw. At just the last moment, the instructor spun himself around through 180 degrees so that he would hit the ground first, with Gareth on top of him. Seconds later, the instructor was dead, having absorbed the full blow and impact, and Gareth miraculously escaped with his life. Now, that's just a staggering illustration of one man paying the price for another man to be saved. Captured on video. They didn't have much choice. They were plunging to the ground at 120 miles an hour. There was only those last few seconds for this man to even think about what he was doing. But in an act of self-sacrifice, he with a desperate attempt to save this guy, he just swung himself around and took the impact himself. One man dying to save another man. But what Jesus has done for us, my friends, is a much, much, much bigger deal than that, isn't it? What Jesus has done for us, it wasn't some split-second decision that he made. This was something planned from before the foundations of the earth. This is something from all eternity that he planned to do for us. He is the Lamb that was slain before the foundations of the world. And look what it says in verse 19. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, in Jesus. Or in chapter 2 and verse 9, for in him, in this man, in Jesus, the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily. Do you see? This isn't just one man dying for another. This is Emmanuel, God with us in the manger, on the cross. God was in Christ, reconciling the world to himself. Do you see? Fullness of God in helpless babe. And that baby growing up to die on a cross for us. Again, the wise men get it right, don't they? When they turn up with their birthday presents for Jesus, let's imagine it was his second birthday. It probably wasn't. But it's probably nearer to that than it would be the manger scene. Imagine they turn up with their gifts and it's Jesus' birthday party in the house there in Bethlehem. And these strange guys come in with their three gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh? Myrrh? What kind of present is that for a toddler's birthday party? Embalming fluid? They understood, you see, didn't they? What most people don't understand, that this baby was born to die. Gold for a king, frankincense for a priest, myrrh to anoint his body, because this baby was born to die. The Lord of all creation became the crucified, the one who made heaven and earth. Suspended between heaven and earth. The face, which is the image of the invisible God, the brightness of God's glory, smeared with spittle, caked with blood and sweat and tears, more marred than that of any man. The author of life, dead. And why? What's it all about? What's he doing there on that cross? Look what it says in verse 20. He's reconciling his creation to himself. How does he do it? Does he fight some kind of, I'm sure some of you have been to the Star Wars movie, is it like that? Does he fight some massive, you know, special effects battle in the heavenly realms? How is God going to reconcile his creation to himself? Does he come with an army? Does he come with a show of power to defeat his enemies? What does he do? He makes peace through his blood shed on the cross. And so he reconciles to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. Eugene Peterson paraphrases it like this: all the broken and dislocated pieces of the universe, people and things, animals and atoms, get properly fixed and fitted together in vibrant harmonies, all because of his death, his blood that poured down from the cross. Remember when the kids were young, tidying up after them? Toys everywhere, drawers left open, food all over the place, bedclothes in disarray, chaos. What a relief when chaos is defeated and everything is put back where it belongs, in its rightful place. That's what Jesus came to do. Your broken life, he's come to fix it. The repercussions of our sin and rebellion on the world around us, on other people's lives, on society, even on the environment, Jesus has come to fix it. And by his death on the cross, he has transformed chaos into cosmos. He has brought peace. Shalom is the Bible word. Well-being. Everything back where it belongs. Don't you hanker after a world like that? Don't you long to live in a world? And man shall live forevermore in a world like that because of Christmas Day. Because of Christmas Day. Everything back where it belongs. Sinners reconciled to a holy God and to one another. Why bother with Christianity then? Because no other religion has this. In the religions of this world, the gods are either aloof and distant, they'd never descend to earth, let alone to the cross, or the gods are small and petty and they would never bleed and die for their creatures. Look at every other religion and you'll see that their gods are either too proud for the cross or too petty for the cross. But on the cross you see the true God. There you see a God who loves you more than his own life, a God who'd rather die for you than live without you. Oh, come, let us adore him, Christ the Lord.